Hello and welcome to Exploring Magnuson Park. I'm your host, Benjamin Warren. On this show, I'll be interviewing organizations located in and associated with Magnuson Park to learn more about who they are, what they do, and how you can get involved. Very excited to welcome Elisa Law from Friends of Magnuson Park back into the studio. Elisa, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Well, we are going to be discussing the first World Flight Centennial, but before we get into that, if you could remind our listeners what your role is at Friends of Magnuson Park and how you got started there.
I'm the executive director of Friends of Magnuson Park. I got started in 2020 when I was asked to design an exhibit about the first world flight. And so that was my introduction to that history and to the organization.
And then the organization itself, can you give us a brief overview of Friends of Magnuson Park's history and what the organization does?
Sure. Yeah, Friends of Magnuson Park has been around for 20 plus years. It is made up of neighbors and people who, when the Navy gave back the land where Magnuson Park now is to the county, these folks were concerned that the historic buildings of the old Navy base were not going to be preserved in any way or going to be allowed to fall into ruin. And, you know, they formed a nonprofit to advocate for that preservation, the preservation of the history of this place, both the aviation and military. Through their advocacy, designated the Sandpoint Naval Air Station Historic District as Seattle's 8th Historic District and got it nationally listed as a historic site, and did a lot of groundwork on setting up protections for the buildings and trees and sight lines and all other kinds of contributing historic resources in the park. So we are currently the only organization that's kind of dedicated to the Sandpoint Naval Air Station Historic District and its interpretation.
Well, part of that history is the first World Flight Centennial, which is being celebrated this year. So started in Sandpoint, April 6, 1924, came back to Sandpoint, September 28, 1924. When we're talking about Sandpoint as the beginning and the ending for the first World Flight, where is that location in relation to Magnuson Park?
Yeah, you know, if you are familiar with the Magnuson Park Cafe and Brewery, if you're on their deck and you're looking east across Lake Washington, that's where they took off, just past the boundary of Magnuson Park into NOAA. So the landing strip was and what's now NOAA's property. So it's just east of Arena Sports parking lot. But you can see where they took off from, which was Lake Washington. They took off on airplanes with pontoons right from in front of the brewery.
And then the airplanes themselves, what can you tell us about those and the pilots and the crew that were involved in this flight?
Yeah, so they left in Douglas World Cruisers, commonly referred to as the ugliest plane ever built. It wasn't built for beauty. It was built to make these long trips, longest trips, you know, ever done, 800-mile hops, like enough fuel capacity to make those journeys and, you know, to be robust enough to withstand all these different temperatures and such. So the Douglas World Cruiser was created specifically for this attempt to fly around the world. And then the Flyers, this was an Army Air Service operation. It was a peacetime military operation, and conceived by General Mason Patrick, who was the head of the Army Air Service at the time. And he went out and chose four pilots, and each of those pilots chose four mechanics. And in some cases, they were secondary pilots themselves mm-hmm. to fly around. So it was a team of four planes, 8 flyers. Yeah, they... If you can imagine, you know, post-World War I, the United States Army Air Service is pretty atrophied at this time. There's not a lot of money going into aviation, even though every day somewhere in the world there's a new record being broken. You know, it's the beginning of the golden age of flight. It's really exciting time, but still there's not a lot of public trust in flying. It's like when we think about people just jumping in a rocket and going to space, like, yeah, I'd rather not. That seems a little untested. You know, I've heard a lot of crashes about a lot of crashes. And, you know, this is crazy. This is never going to become like a commercial, you know, flying every weekend somewhere type of deal like it is today. So there's all these pilots who had flown in World War One, you know, who are now kind of out of a job. They don't have, and they've got the taste. They have got the taste of flight. And, you know, I think Lowell Thomas said it in his book about the First World Flight. Like, once you get a taste of that, like, feeling of untrammeled freedom, you know, you just really can't, you can't ever give it up. You can't go back.
All right. Well, going back to Sandpoint, why was that location chosen specifically for this attempt to fly around the world for the first time?
Yeah, that's a good question, because I think even to this day, there is some amount of contention around the start and end. I wouldn't be surprised if during the centennial year, you know, Santa Monica was like, we were the real start and finish. Or Eugene, Oregon was like, we were the real start. You know, there are other cities, because the Douglas World Cruisers were picked up from the Douglas plant in Santa Monica. And, you know, they didn't leave together. They, you know, three of them left and the other one had trouble. This was their first, like, test flight. And they, when they got to Seattle, they had 3 weeks of preparations to make and pontoons to put on their planes. So really, it wasn't until they got to Sandpoint that they had that they were together, that they had tested the aircraft, that they had completed their aircraft, that they had, you know, made final preparations. So I think probably reason number one was that they needed to go this easterly route around the world with pontoons on their planes. They needed to take off from water and fly, you know, across the Pacific and, you know, land in the water through Japan and until they reached India. And so they weren't going to be able to put those pontoons on until they kind of reached Seattle as their, you know, as their taking off point. That's reason number one. And reason number two, if they had started in Santa Monica, they would lose 3+ weeks of all of that prep time in Seattle if we're going for, you know, a record here on, like, how fast. And this was a race, by the way. Did we talk about that?
Mm-mm.
No, this is a race amongst nations to be the first to be able to say that they had created an airplane that could do this and that they had the flyers and the technology and everything, to the engineers, to pull this off. And so it was, you know, it was Argentina, France, England, Italy, and Portugal. And they all had a dog in the fight, so to speak. And so it wasn't official. They weren't all starting from the same place or at the same time. They had different aircraft. Like, we had 4 planes going out. Some people had, you know, just one, but then they were, like, switching airplanes, like, throughout. Everybody had their own deal, but the goal was to circumnavigate the Earth. So, you know, time was kind of the essence.
And how close did the other countries come to completing their circumnavigation or timeline compared to the U.S.?
That's a good question. Because everybody took off from different points and landed at different points, I have not crunched those numbers, but at a glance, not close. because I think it was only the Italian flyer that was still in the race by the time, you know, we were about to hop across the Atlantic. We'd gone like 3/4 of the way and we were almost home. There was only one last person in the race.
Okay. So U.S. took the gold on that one, so to speak. And you've talked about how this was kind of seen as impossible. This was not going to happen. Weren't going to be able to fly around the world, at least not yet, but it was accomplished. Why is this, other than it being an impossible mission that was completed, what is so important about this historic event that we are remembering it on the centennial?
I think that, yeah, apart from the obvious that it was this accomplishment, first to do it, and, you know, a race, and it was a, you know, American patriotism, and it was also an international cooperation. It was like the largest peacetime military operation in history. It wasn't just the Army Air Service sending out these flyers. There were all sorts of branches of military who were involved in the flight. There were 36 Navy destroyers strategically positioned around the route to rescue them in case of an emergency, you know, ocean landing, which did happen a couple times. And it took the logistics, it's not sexy. No one wants to talk about like the logistics of setting such a thing up. But these are, you know, not every country had a good relationship with the U.S. at that time. And despite that, they were like, everyone's imaginations were, you know, totally captivated by this attempt. Like, okay, yeah, we don't like you, U.S., but you can land your first world flyer. You know, we're gonna invite them to dine with our dignitaries, and we're going to like celebrate this attempt. It was really a humankind's race around the world. It did have a race against all these nations, but it was more than that. It was a cooperative kind of attempt with all the countries that they landed in, which I believe was 22, and there was a spirit of sportsmanship that I find really inspiring. Like I said, our pilots had all these support systems that maybe the other countries didn't have. And so we supported other racers from other countries with our resources. Hmm. So like the British flyer, McLaren, he went down at some point and then wasn't able to like get his spare plane. He was far away from his spare plane. And that was going to be it for him. And the U.S. flyers, we were in Japan at the time, we're like, We're gonna get that spare plane to McLaren. Get that destroyer to pick up his plane at this, you know, use our resources, pick up the plane and deliver it to him. Get him back in the race. That was like number one. And then the British helped us out. They like outfitted us when we got to India with, you know, helmets so that we wouldn't get, so that the sun wouldn't penetrate our skulls and drive us mad. Oh. So we got these special skull protecting madness preventing helmets. And then the Italian flyer went down between Greenland and Iceland, and we were kind of buddies with him. And if not for us sending out a ship to go find him, it was not looking good. Like that would have been the end of the Italian flyers. And so we rescued some people. We got some people back in the race. We collaborated with all these countries. It was, you know, it was a beautiful thing. And all these countries that hosted our flyers as they landed and kept on their journey were, you know, they gave them keys to the city. They gave them all kinds of honorary awards and, you know, they dined with princes and it was a big deal.
Yeah. It sounds obviously like this is a huge deal. And you've mentioned this cooperation between countries, especially in peacetime, which is very significant because you talked about we're just coming off of World War I and kind of this worldwide cooperation to see the pilots achieve this impossible mission. Just an incredible historic achievement and really exciting that Sandpoint, Seattle, we have this tie to this incredible accomplishment. And for Friends of Magnuson Park to commemorate this first world flight centennial, what do you have in the works? You know, April 6th, the start is coming up. You know, you have the whole summer and then September 28th to commemorate the end of the flight. What is Friends of Magnuson Park doing in terms of activities and events?
Oh boy. So on April 6th, we are hosting a kickoff party to celebrate the flyers taking off. And this is going to be 2:00 to 4:00 at Magnuson Park Cafe and Brewery. We're giving away 100 beers for 100 years. They're going to have historians bantering about the flight and have a raffle giveaway, you know, including, you know, free flight lessons, and you know it's going to be a party. And I think there's regatta also happening at Sail Sandpoint. So it's going to be a bunch of people and a big party atmosphere spilling out onto the you know, along the shores of Lake Washington, where that historic, you know, runway, so to speak, was. So there's more information about that on our centennial website, which is firstworldflightcentennial.org. And that's our big kickoff. And between the kickoff and September 28th, we are launching a 175-day, which is the amount of time it took them to get around, Instagram, the follow the journey kind of experience where every day you're checking in with the flyers like, oh, they're in, now they're in Japan, now they're in China, now they're in, you know, oh, now they've crashed in a lagoon somewhere and they're like getting dysentery. Oh, now they're buying, you know, $800 communion wine to survive. Wow, like you could follow the adventure because it's such an adventure. You know, it's with, you know, the limited amount of time you have to ever like to pitch the elevator pitch for this story, you don't get the pleasure of telling all these like little things that happen to them. And you really get to know the flyers. And so we have this Instagram account that's going to just be 175 days long. And we would love for you, everybody to follow that and enjoy the journey so that by the time you get to September 28th, the landing, you will really, you know, feel like the you'd follow the journey on the with the newspapers like people had done. Seattleites, 50,000 people came out here for the landing. That's like a significant portion of the population back then. What we have planned for the landing is a multi-day event co-hosted with the Museum of Flight, September 26th through the 29th. The 28th is the day that they landed, and that's going to be our big party here at Sandpoint. It's mostly hosted at NOAA because, like I said, that's where the runway was, is technically on NOAA property. So we're going to have a big stage set up and speakers and military officials and bands and food trucks and vendors. And we're going to have a big vintage aircraft flyover and people who've flown over around the world talking about their experiences and how it relates to the first world flight. And it ought to be a lot of fun. And then leading up to that, a couple days leading up to that, Museum of Flight will display all of those vintage aircraft so you can go and see them and learn about them before they do the big flyover. And the day after the event also, you can have one last look at them. But we're bringing in some significant, really cool aircraft, which I can't talk about right now. But if you're an aviation nerd, this is for you. And if you're not, this will make you one.
Right. So starting with the Instagram page, where would somebody go to find that Instagram profile so they can follow the flight?
First World Flight Centennial, at First World Flight Centennial on Instagram. That's my favorite part of putting this together is getting to tell that day-by-day story, finding the photographs, the objects that are in collections all over the country, the newspaper articles, the diary entries of these flyers. Like, it took a lot of work and research to amass the story. And so it's exciting to me that locals and people, you know, all over the country, perhaps, and the globe would be remembering and like reliving this.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of those artifacts that are part of this history and part of the First World Flight, what can folks see now, maybe in Magnuson Park, associated with Friends of Magnuson Park, or in the Seattle Pacific Northwest area, those artifacts that are tied to this point in history?
Well, there's the monument, which probably most folks don't know is associated with the First World Flight, but at the 74th Street entrance on Sandpoint Way to the park, there's that winged obelisk standing sentinel there. And if you can brave the crosswalk during, you know, a red light and go and look, that was put there for the 1924 landing. The day after they landed, they came and revealed that monument to the flyers, and they were all very surprised, like, oh my gosh, we have a monument. And so that is one relic that survives. It was moved several times. It wasn't originally there. It was originally over where NOAA is. And so that's one. Two is that exhibit that I mentioned, going full circle to how I came on board with Friends and learned about this flight. Our exhibit is in Mercy Magnuson Place, which is open to the public 8 to 5 Monday through Friday. It's in like that the middle entrance to that big, the old Navy Barracks building. It's a big white middle part of the building. And it's our main entrance. And it's right there. And then in terms of other relics that still exist from the First World Flight outside of Magnuson, there's a really old hangar that was there at the takeoff and the landing that was moved to Port Townsend to Jefferson County Airport. And so it's still there. It's like the oldest hangar in like west of the Mississippi or something. Wow. It's really old. So if you find yourself in Port Townsend, go and touch that hangar and know that, you know, these famous flyers were preparing their airplanes inside there. And also, you know, Museum of Flight and Museum of History and Industry both have really amazing collections and things associated with the flight in their collection. I think Museum of Flight has a propeller, like one of the spare propellers from the plane. They have a flag that was presented to the flyers by Prince Rupert, and that was for their first stop. They have, you know, the shell casing of the bullet that was shot out of the gun to signify the ending of the First World Flight in their collection. Yeah, and then I don't want to leave out Mohai. Mohai has a bunch of amazing photos and all of the records from the Seattle Chamber of Commerce. They were the ones who put on like the big celebration for the landing and the takeoff. And so all the telegrams and like the fighting kind of happening between like Seattle and Eugene and Santa Monica and like talking to, you know, sending these telegrams to Washington, D.C., being like, we need an official designation that Sandpoint is the beginning and the end, because these other cities are saying it's them, and we've got a monument we're making, and we made them all rings and stuff. We've got a bunch of people coming. If we're not the end, it's going to be so embarrassing. So there's all this fun kind of correspondence that you can see in there. And then finally, maybe what's the most interesting is, you know, the Boeing logo, the current Boeing logo. It's like a globe with a swoop around it, and the swoop has like a rocket on the end of it. When you see that logo, you should think First World Flight, because when Donald Douglas, who made the Douglas World Cruisers, after the flight ended, they wanted to capitalize on the, you know, global recognition of the Douglas World Cruiser as the first to fly around the world. So they created their logo as a globe with these three swoops around it and with Douglas World Cruisers like at the end of the swoops. When Boeing and McDonnell Douglas merged, they put their logos together and they kept the globe with the swoop around it. And that globe and swoop is First World Flight. So,
how cool.
Yeah.
How cool. Well, there is just so much that goes into this. I mean, it spans months out of the year, and it sounds like there is a lot going into it with Friends of Magnuson Park and the other organizations that you are partnering with. You have mentioned firstworldflightcentennial.org and the Instagram page as some places that folks can find more information. Where else might folks go to find out information about the First World Flight and Friends of Magnuson Park?
The website, certainly if it's friends related, the website firstworldflightcentennial.org is the best spot for that. We're compiling historic articles and footage and like linking you out to other collections and other websites. So we're trying to become and have become a hub for First World Flight Centennial history. And it can be a place where you connect to a bunch of other resources. The other great website that's out there is Bob Dempster's SeattleWorldCruiserProject.org. But Bob Dempster did a full replica of one of the Douglas World Cruisers and named it the Seattle 2. The Seattle, as a side note, crashed in Alaska and was, you know, that was the end of that Douglas World Cruiser. I should say four of these Douglas World Cruisers left and only two technically came back and finished the journey. But Bob Dempster, he's a local guy, and he painstakingly recreated this Douglas World Cruiser. And so he has a website that also is totally dedicated, and it's SeattleWorldCruiser.org. That's another great spot.
All right. So FirstWorldFlightCentennial.org, SeattleWorldCruiser.org. Check those out for more information about the First World Flight Centennial. And with all of these activities and events going on, are there any volunteer opportunities for folks who want to get involved, and what do those look like?
Absolutely. We're going to need lots of hands at the event on the 28th, people to greet and to, you know, kind of control crowds and traffic and just like point people in the direction of the bathrooms and, you know, volunteer in various ways for that day. So, and also research, you know, I could use some help tracking down images and things. So if you've got a research interest and you want to get in touch, we can definitely put you to work. If you've got outreach connections with people who would be interested in the history and getting involved in the event, we'd love to talk to you. I think we could create an opportunity to volunteer for like anybody and their interests. We want it to be like a big party and have as many people involved in using their skills to promote it as possible. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, for folks who are interested in volunteering, where would they go to sign up or get more information?
Yep. That firstworldflightcentennial.org page and then just connecting with us through there.
Okay. And for folks who may not have the time or the ability to volunteer for these events, how else can they contribute to the activities going on with First World Flight or Friends of Magnuson Park in general?
Great question. Thanks for setting me up for that. We have a sponsorship package that's on the Centennial website. And so if you want to give your time, that's great. If you want to give your treasure, that's also great. There's opportunities to get brand recognition on our programs and at the event on stage. And if you wanted to get your business or yourself out there and be associated with the First World Flight Centennial, we have avenues through which to do that. And I would love to talk to you about getting involved in that way.
All right. So a lot going on with this. And I know Exploring Magnuson Park, this show, will be keeping folks updated on what's going on. Felix Bunnell with Cascade of History, I know he'll be doing some shows as well. Also part of the Space 101.1 FM programming. With all of that going on, I'm not sure if it leaves Friends of Magnuson Park much time to do anything else, but are there other events or activities coming up maybe this summer that you would like to highlight for our listeners?
You know, in the summer, we usually do walking tours. Mm-hmm. And so those are listed on our website when they come up or on Facebook as well. Facebook is a good place to keep track of those. And, you know, since we're a very small organization and are biting off a huge project, all of our focus is basically going towards planning this event and giving presentations around town on the history and these walking tours. So we don't have any other events specifically planned besides the launch and the completion. But in between, we'd love to come and talk to your organization and razzle-dazzle them about the First World Flight. Yeah, and then the other project that we're doing this year, funding dependent, is Building 12, which was the old steam plant just east of the Mountaineers, is getting some work done to it by Parks. And we have a grant application out to the Department of Neighborhoods to paint murals on the 28 windows that are going to be covered up with plywood. So instead of just putting plywood up, like putting plywood that has some beautiful history attached to it about the steam plant, very much like the Building 41 murals that we did about aviation. Mm-hmm. So kind of recreating that, but with the steam plant. So if we get our funding from Department of Neighborhoods, we'll be doing that in the spring while we're running around like chickens with our heads cut off.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, hopefully that all works out and we will see those amazing murals, just like the ones on Building 41 and the gas station very soon during this summer. As we are wrapping up here, I have one final question for you. Last time you were on, you mentioned that the song Into the Mystic by Van Morrison is one that you associate with Friends of Magnuson Park and the First World Flight. Is that still your pick for a song that you associate with the event?
Ben, it is. It's like, and I said in my last interview, not to, you know, be a one-trick pony here, but the content of the First World Flight, like the book about the First World Flight, which has all of the flyers' diary entries and like their like personal and very spiritual accounts of this journey, it's a very like spiritual experience for them. And when I was reading that book, I heard for somehow the first time this Van Morrison Into the Mystic song, and I thought, oh wow, this is what they were experiencing. It's the lyrics: hark now, hear the sailors cry, like smell the sea and fill the sky, let your soul and spirit fly into the mystic. That's exactly what they were experiencing. And you know, and the sailors crying to them from, you know, their ships, like cheering them on. It's mm-hmm. It's the song. It's their song. In my mind, it's their song.
Well, it is the perfect song for kind of that event, for that flight around the world centennial happening this year. To shake things up a little bit with the song, do you have a current song that is your favorite or one that you're listening to a bunch?
This is going to reveal my listening habits, but I really love and listen to on repeat the Tiny Ruins song Tread Softly, which is based on a Yeats poem, and it's just so beautiful, and I listen to it on repeat when it's raining with a fire going in my fireplace. You can imagine me in there just like wistfully looking out the window thinking about aviation and poetry.
Well, it sounds like a great song. I will have to check it out. Thank you so much for being here. My guest today was Elisa Law from Friends of Magnuson Park, talking about the First World Flight Centennial. So check out firstworldflightcentennial.org for more information about all the incredible activities going on with that. Elisa, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Exploring Magnuson Park. My guest today was Elisa Law from Friends of Magnuson Park, who shared information about the upcoming First World Flight Centennial. Saturday, April 6 marks the 100th anniversary of the first round-the-world flight, and you can celebrate with Friends of Magnuson Park by joining them at the Magnuson Park Cafe and Brewery on Saturday, April 6 from 2 to 4 p.m. for their 100 Beers for 100 Years event. The first world flight started and ended at Sand Point, taking place over several months from April 6 to September 28, 1924. Friends of Magnuson Park will be commemorating the flight with more activities and exhibits, so make sure to visit friendsofmagnusonpark.org and firstworldflightcentennial.org for more information about what else Friends of Magnuson Park has planned and to learn more about this historic event. Some upcoming events happening in Magnuson Park, the Taco Libre Truck Showdown will take place on Saturday, April 6th from 4 to 10 p.m. at Hangar 30. The event is only for individuals 21 and older and features an array of taco trucks, margarita bar, an illuminated night market, and captivating high-flying wrestling performances. Check out 206nightmarkets.com for more information and to get your tickets in advance. Another event coming to Magnuson Park, the Best of the Northwest Spring Show, will take place on Saturday, April 13th and Sunday, April 14th from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at Hangar 30. This two-day show offers handmade art in all mediums by over 100 talented artists. Check out nwartalliance.org for more information and to get your tickets in advance. A special thank you to everyone who contributes to Space 101.1 FM. It's your donations that make this show and all of our programs possible. If you'd like to contribute, want to learn more about the station, are looking for a schedule of our programs, or would like to listen online, visit our new and improved website at space101fm.org. I'd also like to mention a new program on Space 101.1 called Electric Waves. This weekly show is a roundup of dance music from across the globe, so tune in on Wednesdays from 11 p.m. to midnight for Electric Waves. And don't forget to tune in again next Thursday at 2 p.m. for more Exploring Magnuson Park. I'm your host, Benjamin Warren, broadcasting from Space 101.1 FM, the coolest radio station in the galaxy. Have a wonderful day, and we'll see you at Magnuson Park. Walking.